quite a difficult task, because in the audience I see a selection of people who clearly know everything about protein-protein interactions, and I suspect some others who aren't so familiar with them. So I'll try to have a mixture of things in here. And what I'm going to do is to just perhaps provide a summary of this is really an outline of my talk. I'll talk a little bit about different types of protein-protein complexes, just to set the scene. I'll say a little bit about inferring quaternary structure from crystal structures. I'll then talk about what we've been looking at analysing higher order multimers, as well as dimers, trimers, up to hexamers. And I'll finish with a short discussion of transient complexes. But please do interrupt me if you have questions as we go through. In terms of different sorts of complexes, this really describes attributes of complexes that are absolutely familiar, I'm sure, to anybody who's thought about them, but I think it is important because they do change the nature of the interactions between the proteins. So obviously we can have homomultimers and heteromultimers, as in the alpha 2 and a complex of alpha alpha, both the same chain or two different chains. When you have two different chains, as in hemoglobin, those two chains are often homologous. They're often related to each other. And that's really very common throughout all multimeric structures. We can have, in terms of the time which the complex stays intact, it can either be effectively permanent. Now, as we all know, no complexes are totally permanent, but for all purposes, for biological perspectives, some multimers always exist in their multimeric state in solution, whilst others are clearly transient, so they can make and break. And often that making and breaking of the complexes is the key biological effector. And lastly, we have what we've described as obligate and non-obligate interactions. So this means that some multimers, you never see the individual protomer by itself effectively in solution, and those are obligate. Whilst others, very important protein-protein complexes, like proteinase inhibitor complexes, they only occur when the two molecules meet each other in solution. And often they will not meet each other, and they have to exist quite independently in solution. And therefore their surfaces have to be water-soluble. Whereas for the obligate complexes, some of them clearly do not exist as a folded state in solution. They have to form the complex in order to fold up. And I'm sure you've been hearing about the folding and unfolding. So these different states, this permanent and transient, some complexes make and break effectively as a concentration or a temperature or a pH, a sort of context. Others are clearly triggered to form complexes, either by perhaps a phosphate or a metal ion or something like that. So there are different mechanisms by which transience occurs. So moving then to inferring quaternary structure from crystallography, because I think what I and several other people in the audience have tried to do has been to look at what we can learn about protein-protein complexes by looking at their detailed three-dimensional structures. And of course, in a crystal environment, it's effectively infinite, and you have all sorts of interactions going on in the crystal lattice, as well as the specific protein-protein interactions that occur in the biological multimer. And so the problem is illustrated here for this formyl transferase is this molecule, given its lattice environment, a monomer, a dimer? And if a dimer, which are the dimeric pairs, the blue red or the green red, or the function, or the tetramer as shown here? And so what we wanted to do was to, given this just illustrates it schematically, a crystal lattice here, do we have this dimer, this dimer, this dimer, or this tetramer? So that's really quite a challenge that is surprisingly not always easy to solve. So, and the reason for doing this was that we really wanted to look at these higher order complexes. This goes back some time. And to do that, we had to have a data set where we were confident that we had monomers, dimers, trimers, tetramers, and so on. And so we needed to create this data set. And so we decided that we'd go and look through the PDB and everything. And of course, it's immediately apparent in the PDB that it doesn't tell you what the biological multimer is, almost ever. And so then we thought, right, we'll go and look in the papers and see what we can find. In many of the papers, it doesn't tell you what the biological... It's just sort of assumed that you know, because when people work on proteins for a long time, they know what the multimeric state is. And often it just isn't mentioned in the papers. And so we wanted to try to develop an automatic approach to defining... to see if we could automatically, from the crystal lattice, say whether what the multimeric state was. So to do that, we needed, if you like, a gold standard against which to test any algorithms that were developed. And so we set about creating a data set which would have been really manually annotated. So we took the monomers and dimers that we took from the PDB and from places like SwissProt, where there is reasonable annotation. And we also, for all of these, checked with the literature to see what it actually said about the complexes. And we tried to, Hannes Ponstingel, who I can't actually, he doesn't seem to be here, but he will be, he is supposed to be around. He's the person who really did most of this work with a few other people, and tried to develop this model to define the states. And so the question is, what are the parameters that one can use to define where the likely interface is? And the first one is the accessible surface area for the that's in the largest interface in the crystal. And I should actually go through. So effectively, if you look at the this is the tin barrel dimer, and when you separate out, so I will call each part a protomer, and when you separate out, then you form the area that is buried between the two halves, and that's the interface. And you can measure the size of that area by something called accessible surface area calculations, ASA. And it's measured in angstrom squared. It's an area.
If there's a pocket in there, what do you do about that?
So the way that you... it somewhat depends. When you... the way you do the calculation is that you calculate...
I have a slide on that. I have a slide.
You have... Basically, you roll a water molecule around the surface of here, and you separate it out, and you calculate it separately and together, and then if there's a pocket, it depends on whether the water molecule can get into that pocket or not. So depending on the size, it may or may not be included. Yeah, sorry. So Joel will elucidate further on that. So one of the key criteria that's been recognised for many years, initially by Joel, who is sitting over here, and we'll talk this afternoon, Joel Janine and Cyrus Chothia, the size, you can look at the size of that interface, that green part on the previous slide, and you can plot for the dimers and the monomers the distribution. So I should say, for the monomers, you look in the crystal contact and just take the largest crystal contact, and you compare the largest crystal contact with the size for both monomers and dimers. So you're just looking at the largest crystal contact. And what you can see here is that the dimers in general have larger interfaces than the monomers that we've got here. And you can make a cutoff at about 800 angstrom squared. And that will...
Excuse me, does this depend on the monomer size at all?
So I will...
Oh, sorry.
Come on to this. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So you can... This was just... essentially, not really, no. you can look at this distribution, and you can see that for some proteins, it's very clear that you have a monomer, a dimer. For some, it's clear that it's a monomer. But there's a set in the middle where it's really not so clear, where there is an overlap. That is just based on size. Nothing at all to do with the chemistry of the interface. So whether you've got a good match or a bad match. But you have to remember that, of course, you're comparing interfaces that exist in nature. The crystal might not be biological, but it still exists in nature, so it's still a good stable interface, or the crystal wouldn't have formed in the first place. So all the contacts that we're comparing, whether they're dimers with monomers, are all extant, if you like. They're all physically reasonable contacts. You then can say, well, let's throw in the chemistry. Let's look at the chemical matching between these two interfaces. How good is that matching? And you can measure that in various ways using the classic sort of empirical, semi-empirical potentials, the Coulomb's law, that sort of measure. Or in this case, Hannes did it using pair score distributions, which are total empirical calculations derived from looking at crystal structures originally. And this effectively measures the complementarity, the chemical complementarity of the surface. When you do that, and now, of course, energy is always negative, so it's shown the other way round, but basically you get the same sort of distribution where some of the dimers are clearly dimers and some of them are clearly monomers, but again, you get this overlap. And again, you can make a threshold at a given value that will give you a certain error rate associated with making this prediction. So how good are these calculations? So this is now just doing a cutoff and saying if you're on this side, you're a monomer, and on that side, you're a dimer. How good is doing that? If you use accessible surface area, the error is about 13%. And that goes up slightly when you do a bootstrap to make sure that you're doing it correctly. If you then include the chemistry, then you reduce the error a certain amount, but in fact only by about 3%. So although I thought that the chemistry would make a big difference, it's clearly the problem that you're looking... Well, let me summarise. Clearly, the size measure is extremely powerful. It gives, you know, to me it's surprisingly powerful. I wouldn't have thought it would have done anything like so well. And that it's also clear that that you have a sort of a minimum contact size, about 800 angstrom squared. The statistical potentials, or in fact, I think almost any other potential, it really doesn't matter too much what sort of potential you use, will improve by about 3% on accessible surface area. It combines the chemical information, but of course, to do this calculation with the potentials, you need the atomic resolution. You can't just do it if you don't know in detail how the atoms are interacting. And so if you're trying to model, that's much more difficult to do.
You've got the accessible surface area against some measure of binding affinity. Is that
so? It does. I think perhaps Joel will talk about that this afternoon.
We'll not talk about it.
Oh, you won't talk? No, it doesn't.
That's keeping it a secret.
It's actually very interesting because it's remarkably bad correlation, actually. One of the problems is getting binding affinities that are comparable across a set. You look in the literature and they're all at different temperatures, different pHs, different environment, and you really don't have a good feel exactly what you're comparing with what. But it doesn't. It really doesn't correlate.
That seems to be a problematic aspect of this classification of a binding interface and non-binding interface, because depending upon conditions, you can have free energies of interaction that will bring you from sub-nanomolar concentrations to millimolar concentrations.
I could not agree more. This is a major challenge. And it always, whenever I come and speak in this place, I always end up saying the key problem is calculating delta G. And it really is for everything. You know, for all these sort of theoretical analyses,
Come down and say that you have now a standard for deciding that this is a monomer and this is a dimer, just on the basis of structure, without taking all these things into account, seems to be a really kind of an ill-defined proposition.
Well, the fact is that it works well for 87% of the examples, and therefore practically, which is what we were initially trying to set up this auto, because the PDB has got 26,000 structures in it, which are not defined as whether they're monomers, dimers, trimers, or tetramers.
And if you added evolutionary information and looked at residue conservation, surely the crystal contact residues would be less conserved. Is that coming up next? Or?
Well, in fact, no, it's not coming up next. Perhaps Hannes might like to... Well, I saw Hannes had wandered in briefly. Where are you? Hannes might like to comment on that, because he's currently... It's surprisingly not as helpful as we hoped. Hannes?
Well, all I can say is that the sequence conservation is weaker than you would think. I mean, there are families that change the interface slightly. And we have the problem that we have strong conserved residues from enzyme active sites that sometimes are in the interface.
But when an amino acid changes in an interface, is there a complementary change with the partner or not? Or that's sometimes yes, sometimes no?
Well, people claim to be able to observe these correlated mutations.
Yes, exactly. That's
we have looked at the dimer.
Yeah.
I mean, this is very special molecules anyway, but we haven't been able to detect this signal.
Yes, you did prove that it was useful, however.
Okay.
Hannes studied that, and the answer, it is useful, but it's not decisive. That's what he said.
Yeah.
That's right. I think one of the problems is, if you do it with... if you do it totally automatically, and you take a protein, and you get all the... For those people who aren't familiar with this, the way that you do it is you take your sequence and you run it through all the sequence databases, you pull out all the relatives, and you ask whether the interface has been conserved biologically. And if you do it completely automatically, it really can lead to some problems. Will Valdar, who was a member of the group, did this, and he found that if he did it by hand and looked very carefully at the particular protein and made sure that all the sequences in his alignment were almost certainly had the same function, so they weren't very distant relatives, they were relatively, I mean, more than 40%, then there was no evidence for different multimeric states, then you could find that you had conservation. One of the problems, though, is that ASA works so well, except the size works so well, that actually you don't have an enormous amount to play with to get it better. So you end up with 2 or 3% improvement, depending on what you do. And so it does help, but it's not... And the complementary mutations that Hannes mentioned, they they've been observed in all sorts of, in the interior of proteins and everything. They're clearly there, but they are not very useful for prediction because they occur all over the place. And it's difficult to separate out and really use them predictively. Hannes?
Just to put numbers on it, I think in the dimer case, we looked at this sequence conservation and we found that when you use conservation alone, you get approximately 70% accuracy rate. And this is not correlated with any other parameter that we looked at. So you improve on the, when you combine the two parameters, that size and conservation, you improve by 3 or 4%.
Are these two data sets available for people to play?
Yeah. They're in the papers anyway.
Yeah, on our website. Yeah.
And they're on the website.
You can just download all the data.
I don't know how much more discussion you want to have, but for the naive statistical mechanics in the audience, your response to Alan Minton was a little bit unsatisfactory. I mean, you obviously have in mind, as you said, some sort of physiological conditions, but I'm left up in the air as to what, and you know, if I find life under extreme circumstances, should I expect these analyses to be useful or not? I'm left a little confused as to precisely what you have in mind.
I think I have in mind doing something that was practical and tractable at this stage in our knowledge of structures.
But I agree. Tell us what practice means. I mean,
you solve a crystal structure. Many people are out and they say, "Have I got a dimer or a trimer?" And so, I mean, actually, that's an easy one. But if it's a dimer or a tetramer, and they want some mechanism to at least set their to be able to use their structure in the knowledge of what's already gone before. And this, in a sense, provides that sort of help. It also, I think, begins to address some of the questions. I couldn't agree more. We would dearly love to calculate delta G values. But at the moment, the fact is that accessible surface area works very nearly as well as the best we can do. Which
well,
is very
I'm happy
frustrating.
With that. But I mean, your answer, I think, is that practice means what people have done so far, and therefore, if I'm looking far outside the range of the sorts of conditions people have looked at, then I should be aware. Is that fair?
We have not looked at all. I don't know whether Joel or Hannes at extreme. But I mean, crystals are fairly extreme.
You can find ways of dissociating your dimer, even so it's obvious.
Yeah.
There are almost certainly ways of making a dimer. Okay? Here, the definition is a biochemist. Under the conditions I normally work with that protein, I find it to be a dimer. Somebody else will complain that he's found another peak and so on. But even that question, Janet is telling you, even that question is not easy to solve just by looking at the physics of the structure. And we are doing structural genomics, very often we solve structures of proteins we know nothing about, not even if they are dimers. So that would be one application of that.
That's right.
General
ideas. I couldn't, you know, I would dearly love, and when we started this, I thought that the pair thing was going to solve our problems. That's what I thought, and it blatantly didn't. The other question I think that we have to ask is whether actually some of these structures that are on the extremes are correctly assigned in the literature. I think this is a big problem. They may well be monomers or dimers and wrongly assigned. But without actually going into the lab and retesting and doing this and doing them all under similar conditions, it's very, very difficult to really get that.
I have a question. I mean, just to make sure that I understand this area. 800 square angstrom seems to be a huge area for a crystal contact. So if it is 700 square angstrom, it's still a crystal contact.
Crystal contacts tend to be much smaller. Most crystal contacts are much, much smaller.
Yes.
Very much smaller. But there are quite often larger ones. So this is pair score, so let me... So these are the monomers. That is the size of the largest crystal contact in those monomers. And you can see that most of them, many of them, are 600 angstroms. You know, there are quite a lot of large contacts.
Which is quite a big number.
Quite a big number. That's right. That's right. Sorry, I should have put in, I've got some, for those who aren't familiar, just to give you a feel for how big these things are. Generally, when you get a protein, I should have shown you some pictures, because they're funny shapes, and they're just to give you a feel of what these look like. And sometimes they're, most often they're reasonably round, but sometimes they're a bit more elongated, and they cover, if you look at a normal 200 residue protein, they tend to cover about, from one side, perhaps a half of the surface area. So it's quite a big blob.
So crystal contact is not a point-like contact.
The crystal contact is also large.
It could be,
yeah.
But it's not point.
Janet, do you recall which protein is the outlier with about 7,600 for the Delta ASA?
No, I don't. Hannes, do you remember?
Remember.
You don't remember. Hannes doesn't remember. There's no chance that I'm going to remember. No, no. But these are the ones that do this sort of thing. So most of these, for those again who are, most crystal contacts are fairly flat, and they tend to be this sort of thing. And actually, they're more like this. The side chains tend to interdigitate, but they can still fairly easily pull apart. But there are some which are more like this, where they're entwined, but not really that many. But the very large contacts tend to be those. Or there are dimers that do what's called domain swapping, where you've basically got each protomer has got two bits, and they sort of swap round they go like that, so that they swap domains, and that causes very large surface contacts as well.
It should be borne in mind that the experimental conditions that you use in order to crystallize a protein are precisely what Telemans was talking about. Yes, Alamint was talking about yesterday, of solvent exclusion and molecular crowding. So you are forcing protein-protein interactions in order to produce a crystal, which is of course an optimized protein-protein interaction network. Mm. So you will see interactions. You are driving towards that sort of situation. So if you have a monomer dimer equilibrium that's around a milligram per mil sort of range, you are always more concentrated than that in order to crystallize. Therefore, you will shift the equilibrium towards an associated rather than unassociated state.
Yep. Okay. Right. So then we try to build on this. So that was all work looking just at the simple monomer dimer. And we tried to build on that to look at whether we could differentiate monomers, dimers, tetramers, and hexamers. And this is a horrid table, I apologize. But basically, what Hannes did, and he's written an algorithm, and you should ask Hannes at the back there about the algorithm, but it's basically a slice and dice sort of algorithm where you take your lattice, you identify the point of weak, the best point to cleave. It's, Hannes calls it cookie crumbling. You identify the point of, the easiest point of cleavage in the lattice, if you like, for the asymmetric unit plus all the bits around it. And so you break that first, and then you do that sequentially. So you take each part and break it, always breaking along the easiest line of cleavage. And using the cutoff areas as the delimiter as to when you stop breaking it into parts. Okay? So you can say, if I have something that's more than 800 angstrom squared approximately, then I won't break it anymore. So you're basically cutting it up like that. So then you can take your dime. That, and you can say, well, of the monomers, we have 95 in total. So this gives us the total number. And then the 90 out of 95 are correctly predicted to be monomers using this procedure. That's really quite good. But you will see then, if we look at dimers, that out of our 76... we only correctly predict 55. If we look at trimers, we get 15 out of 24. Tetramers, which are the worst in some ways, 17 out of 31. And you can see here that you get a lot of dimers and some monomers. And then hexamers, again, we get only about 3 out of 10. And for when you have hexamers, you have dimers of trimers and trimers of dimers, and it gets much more complicated in trying to split them up. So in total, really, this our hope that we could automatically classify the PDB is really not yet realised. And this is very frustrating, because for these proteins, you kind of know more about them than any other proteins. And yet, we still, even with knowledge of the lattice, we cannot very accurately identify what the multimeric state is. And in particular, one would love to be able to take a sequence and predict whether it was likely to form a dimer or a trimer or a tetramer just from the sequence. And the idea of being able to do that when we can't even do it when we've got the crystal lattice is a bit deflating, shall we say. Yeah.
Quick question. We discussed a number of times here in the Institute, which is that it knows that there are no fibers, right? Now, we know you can't tile space with
There are pentamers.
Well, why there are none in your...
Well, there weren't any in our data set. No, there are fibers, but they are relatively rare. The dimers and the tetramers tend to dominate.
So one of the things we were wondering, perhaps, was whether that was...
Shape.
Whether that was an artifact of crystallization, because pentamers are hard to crystallize, or whether that was had some kind of physiological reason, that there's a reason why there are fewer pentamers than hexamers.
I don't think it's a crystal thing, because I...
You can't tell space with...
Oh, no, what you're saying is it's hard to superimpose the point symmetry of the pentamer on the crystal.
That's right.
On a crystal lattice. You can't do that. But there's no problem about crystallizing a pentamer. There's nothing because inherently uncrystallizable about a pentamer. What you can't do is map its point symmetry onto a crystal lattice, but that doesn't stop it crystallizing.
Yeah.
The protein doesn't know anything about the lattice. Let me have a copy.
The pentamers are fairly globular and look from the outside. You wouldn't necessarily... I mean, sometimes they aren't, but, you know, you wouldn't necessarily know it was a pentamer if you didn't colour the...
In your introduction, you pointed out to us that sometimes physiologically it will change from being a monomer to a dimer.
Yes, yes, yeah.
Doesn't that set some upper bounds on what you should expect to be able to get? I mean, is it clear that your program has failed? See what I'm saying? Because I would have concluded that if physiologically it was going to fairly easy change its monomeric state, physiological purposes, then it seems to me to follow from that that any of your theoretical criteria are going to be rather uncertain around that form.
Yeah, I think that is true, but I think also we chose examples which were fairly robust as far as we could tell. So if we can't do it for this, then it's going to be even worse for the others. And I think, you know, coming back to you, it's because of the delta G's and the fact that we're not calculating those. Sorry, I'm painting a pretty awful picture. This is Hannes' effect on me, because he's been struggling with all this data trying to make sense of it. But it really is quite a difficult challenge. And there is no doubt when you have equilibria and it is a very complex problem. Okay, sorry. So, we perhaps get a quarter of the way through the talk at this rate. So, I'd just like to then move on to looking at the interface itself. So, the question that we thought about over 10 years ago now with Sue Jones was whether, if we looked at a protamer and knew nothing about its multimeric state, could we, from that protamer, identify where an interface with another protein might occur. So we started out looking at this from, and to do that we wanted to say what were the characteristics of the interface area that distinguished it from the rest of the surface. So this is where we were starting from, to see whether one could do that. So just to clarify the definition of residue groups. It's all based on their accessibility to water, to solvent, done using standard calculation methods. And so we can define, first of all, the interior of the protein, which has a relative solvent accessible surface area less than 5%. So we classify the residues on the basis of their accessibility to solvent. The interior, relative to their maximum, if they have less than 5%, we say that they're buried in the interior. And actually, we'll ignore those from now on. On the exterior, so what you see here in the CPK model is obviously all the exterior residues, none of the ones that are buried in the core. And you have this, what we call the free surface in green, and then the interface. Sorry, the blue ones are the ones that are counted as buried. You can just see bits of some of those. This is the interface here, interacting here. This is a trimer, I think. And the interface residues can be either those that are completely buried, which are the red ones, or those that are partially accessible, which in this case are coloured yellow. And we define the definitions we use, because obviously what you get out depends on how you define your interface. We define interface residues as having a change in accessible surface area between the protomer and the complex of more than one angstrom. And for individual atoms, because some things we do at the residue level, some things we do at the atom level, we define a delta ASA of more than 0.01 of an angstrom. And of course, we're looking at, again, we're comparing true multimer contacts with crystal contacts for the monomers. So, first of all, the size of the... So, very simple question. Is the formation of multimers dependent on the size of the protomer? So are larger things or smaller things more likely to form multimers? And so I'll show a series of what are these box and whisker plots they're called. I don't know if you're familiar with them. And I always get this definition wrong, so this is going to be a challenge for me. The boxes represent the middle 50% of the distribution. The quartile, this is the bottom quartile, this is the second and third quartile, and this is the fourth quartile. The whiskers represent the standard deviation? Hannes, I can never remember.
No, it's just means is derived from the normal distribution. It shows outside the whiskers there are likely outliers, so in the distribution. But this is only valid for the normal distribution. And the middle.
Yeah, these are standard deviations, aren't they?
Sorry, what are you?
Aren't they standard deviations where you put the...
This is this constriction around the median.
Yes. So this is the median. Those are the middle quartiles. And those are the external. And then we have outliers lying occasionally like this. Okay. So these plots are really quite a powerful way to represent the distribution. And I'll show quite a lot of them. You can see, just looking here, that the molecular weight doesn't change when you go from a monomer up to a hexamer particular. The variation within any sort is much, much larger than the variation between sorts. And that will be a common theme. So another thing that is quite important, and this really doesn't necessarily refer to... Well, actually, it does... refer in a sense to the formation of multimers. And this is how the total surface area relates to the molecular weight. Because we know as you get larger, just as the surface of a sphere is proportional, the amount of surface area that you bury gets larger as your protein gets larger. And so the accessible surface area doesn't increase linear with molecular weight. It flattens off. So as your protein gets larger, you expose less surface area. And in fact, you have a log-log relationship. And what we can do is to plot this relationship for the single subunits, the protomers, and the entire oligomers. And what you can see is that there is a remarkable straight line both for the single subunits and for the entire oligomers. And that you can work out what the relationship is by obviously fitting the best straight line. What we can see here is the if we had a linear relationship, this would be, that's the maximum possible accessible surface area if the thing was stretched out, is shown on the red line. And the blue line shows a perfect sphere here. What we can see is that both the single subunits and the entire oligomers lie on a straight line that clearly is between these two extremes. It's not a perfect sphere. It has more, because of all the invaginations, it has much more surface area than perfect sphere, but it is actually linear. And this means this relationship reflects the fact that you are close packed in the core of the protein. It really is just a consequence of being close packed in the core. But you can also see that the single subunits obey the relationship more or less as well as the entire oligomers. And that's important because it means that these single subunits behave in much the same way. They aren't much more elongated, for example, in which case they'd have a much higher surface area than if than the protomers. So not only do the whole globule form a complex that's more or less globular, but the individual protomers within it also form that globule. And this is really a remarkable good correlation. The correlation coefficient is about 0.98, right, something like that.
Yeah, in all these examples, you're looking just at homo oligomers, is that right? Just looking for the interaction between...
This is nothing to do with the interfaces. This is now just taking...
Right, but in the...
So, Hannes, are the heteros in here as well as the homos?
Not in this case, no, but later we'll have this.
Not on here, but there are some later on. It doesn't change.
I was just curious as to how many of the data set actually formed a complex with a different protein. The words...
These are dominated by the homo thing, partly because the PDB is totally dominated. We actually still don't have that many examples of hetero complexes in the PDB. I mean, we have a number.
They're being purified to be... not have them. I just wondered how many of them actually form a strong interaction with a different protein.
That we don't know about.
We don't know about. Some
absolutely no idea.
Will be...
Would be potential interfaces. That. That's right. I mean, that might be part of the problem of actually doing the prediction. I agree. But we really don't know at the moment, I don't think.
Because most proteins bind to another protein.
Seems to be. That's right. But this is really referring to then size and shape rather than interaction per se. But it is, I find this a very... To me, it's quite a revealing plot. One, that the correlation is really so good because it tells us something, I think, about the need to balance the core and the burial of hydrophobics in the core with the shape and the surface. Because you can't... Let me carry on. So, obviously, if you have if you had three protomers the same size, one of these protomers was a monomer, the second was a dimer, the third was a trimer. Clearly, as you go to higher oligomers, you're going to bury more surface area in the interface. But you're going to make a larger protein. And so the relationship still holds, because as you get larger, you bury more, and you're following this same exponential relationship as you go larger. And so this shows the accessibility of the isolated subunit against the accessibility of the subunit in the oligomer. And clearly this is then the X's at the bottom here are the monomers, obviously those are the crystal contacts. Here we've got the dimer, trimer, tetramer, hexamer. And what you can see is that as you get larger, you gradually bury more interface, more surface area in the interfaces, which is obviously makes sense. And you can use a very simple prediction that if you know the relationship for a monomer to a dimer, you can build up with the molecular, if you know the relationship between the ASA and the molecular weight, you can predict for a given protomer what the burial should be for a hexamer, for example. And if you do that, you can see the red lines show what you would predict, the red dots show what you would predict, and the observations shown in with these box and whisker plots show the distributions that you actually observe. So they broadly follow that relationship, which is absolutely the consequence of the correlation that we saw before. You can't have it one way without the other. So then you can say, well, it's been known for a long time that the idea is that the protein-protein interactions, especially for the HOMO complexes, are driven by the hydrophobicity. That provides the general glue to bury hydrophobic residues rather than the surface. So you can ask what is the, in a very simple calculation, you can calculate the fraction of the interface that's covered by carbon atoms, and then you can compare that with the fraction of the rest of the surface that's covered by carbon atoms. So you can see that for the surface of any old protein, basically, there is about 0.58 of the surface is covered by carbon atoms. It's quite a high percentage. And you can see this distribution is really quite tight. And again, I think this reflects partly on the nature of a polypeptide chain, but it also reflects on the need for a balance between hydrophobic and hydrophilic on the surface. When you look at the interfaces, obviously, when the interfaces are very small, as in the monomers, which are these X's here, you get a wide distribution. That's always the case. As the interfaces get larger, you get more and more averaging. And you can see here that the average for the interface is 0.62 as compared with 0.58. So the fraction of carbons in the interfaces has only gone up by 4% in effect. And I think, again, this illustrates how subtle the energetics of these interactions are. Given that hydrophobicity is the, well, you will see, the one thing that really does differentiate. So here we've got the carbon atom frequency in proteins. So this is in the entire oligomer. What I was hoping in one of my more optimistic moods was that we might be able, because as you got larger, you had to bury more surface area, I thought that it might be possible to differentiate monomers from hexamers, say, if you had a protein of the same size. Something that then formed a very large complex would bury more of its surface area. And so I thought we might be able to distinguish from the sequence which ones were going to be hexamers and which ones were going to be monomers. Of course, as we've seen, the variation within any one category is much, much larger than the variation between categories. And so that was one of the things that didn't quite work out as we hoped it might do, even though there is an underlying trend there, but the difference is tiny, 4%. And this show just summarizes it. You can see for the frequency of carbon atoms in the entire oligomer, although, of course, it's the same in the single protomer, but you can see that it really just, it gradually creeps up as you go to the higher orders. The median gradually goes up, but again, the variation within one class is much, much larger than the variation within it. So there is an effect there. It's just, it's so subtle that you can't, it's really, really quite difficult. So we can compare the surface with the interface hydrophobicity, and this just tries to illustrate. So this, the blue So what we're plotting here is the average hydrophobic index. It's just a measure of hydrophobicity based on residues. And we're showing the distribution for the interior residues, the blue boxes. So the buried residues are generally very hydrophobic. We're all familiar with that. Although, again, you get large distributions, but generally the average hydrophobic index using this measure is just under one. You can then look at the exterior, i.e. that those residues that are accessible to solvent in the whole multimer, and you can see these are much less hydrophobic down here. And then when you look at the interface for the crystal interfaces, the crystal contacts in the monomers, they are no more hydrophobic than the rest of the surface. But when we look at the interfaces in the higher order multimers, these are clearly more hydrophobic. Although again, we've got large distributions, but there is a clear trend that these interfaces, which are dominated by the, you can see here, these are all homo and these are the heteros, but even for the heteros, you can see that you've got more hydrophobicity than you have for the exterior as a whole. So this idea that hydrophobicity is an important contribution to forming higher or multimers of any sort, I think is clearly borne out by the increased data set. It was recognised ages ago by Joel and Cyrus, but it's clearly been borne out very much and is persistent across all these things. But you can see that we have some where the interfaces are actually not hydrophobic at all. So bear that in mind. We can of course ask about the completely buried versus partly accessible. So you remember when I described the interface, the outside of the interface, if you like, is partly accessible, the inside is completely buried. And what we see is that the, as you would absolutely expect, the completely buried residues in the interface tend to have a hydrophobic index that approaches that you see in the core of a protein, whereas the residues that are partly accessible tend to be much lower and much more like the surface of the protein. So you basically, as you would expect, residues on the edge of the interface tend to be much less hydrophobic. It's the ones that are really buried in the core that are hydrophobic. You can look at... Yes? Oh, sorry. Yeah. I didn't realise. I won't be a minute. So I'll go through these very quickly because they're not... So if we look at the number of hydrogen bonds, we can see that this is more or less average. You get about one hydrogen bond per 100 angstroms, and it's more or less the same in the monomers as in the rest. If you look at the number of salt bridges, you get a lot more salt bridges in the crystal contacts than you get in the rest of the complexes. And this applies also to hetero as well as the homos. We can look at residue types. I think suffice it to say that you find that the, this is complicated, these are homomers, heteromers, monomers. The homomers, so this is the propensity of the residues in the interface compared with the free surface. So for the monomers, the crystal contacts, you can see that the white boxes are all about one. So the crystal contacts are no different from the residues in the interface. The heteromers and the homomers look very similar. You can see the blue and the yellow follow each other reasonably well, though again with large variations. And again, you can see that in general, the heteromers have, that both homomers and heteromers have a lower percentage of the charged residues and a higher percentage of the hydrophobic residues at this end. There's basically no difference between dimers, trimers, tetramers and hexamers in terms of the residues that like to be in their interfaces. Secondary structure, it really doesn't matter. You can make these interfaces out of everything. So this just shows the fraction of helix against the fraction of beta, and you can see you get all sorts of secondary structures in these interfaces. And the planarity, these interfaces tend to be quite planar, but you have to be quite careful because depending on the accessibility of the size of the interface, then clearly size and planarity are related together. But there is, most of these interfaces are planar when you look at them. And that just shows there's not much difference between the different types. And they pack, sorry, there isn't, I'm really not got time to, they pack, you'll talk about the packing. They pack just as well as the interface, the interior of proteins, where you look at the packing of the interface. So that, and again, the atomic packing density, you have to be careful with the size. If you, there appears to be a relationship between the Voronoi volume ratio and the number of interface atoms here. But if you correct for the size of the interface, then that correlation disappears. So they basically are well packed in the core and not so well packed on the outside. So just to summarize then, the size of the contact surface is the best predictor of multimer interface. Chemistry only adds a slight improvement for this particular thing. Automatic annotation of higher order multimers is still unreliable. The ASA is strongly correlated with the molecular weight, both for the protomers and the multimers. And it's also, I've repeated that. And the only really consistent correlation that one finds for the interface addition is the increase in hydrophobicity. So I won't have time to talk about this part, but I would like to acknowledge in particular Hannes Ponstingel and Susan Jones, who worked, Susan initially back at UCL, and Hannes has been working on this now for 5 or 6 years at EBI. And Will Valder looked at the conservation that I've not talked about. Irene looked at the transition, the transient complexes. Thomas Kabir and Denise Gorse have been doing these higher order multimers with Hannes. So thank you. I'm sorry I've gone on a bit.
I have two questions. The first one would be the following. So it seems that what you try to do is to use medical statistics mostly to find the adjustment data that goes to the PDB to identify the unit which exists outside of the crystal. But I know that in many cases people can actually identify these units not from just processing the data, but they've done physical chemistry experiments. And I know many works in which people have identified decamers in existing data solution and entering the crystal as a whole, and things like that. So did you ever compare the predictions of your data processing to the what is actually existing, what actually exists in the solution?
So when we made our, if you like, our gold standard data set, we deliberately took those proteins where the information in solution agreed with the information that we from the not agreed with, but where the evidence that was written, because usually when crystallographers do make crystals, they also run the thing in solution and ask what the multimeric state of the not always, but we specifically usually, and we specifically took those examples where we could, where we had that data available. So in fact, our definitions were based more on the solution rather than the crystal.
Yeah. My second question is... actually, answers so longer than the questions, right? So my second question is the following. This would be the aggregates that exist in solution from which the crystals grow. yet those solutions are very often very different from those solutions in which the protein functions.
That's right. No. When they do their, usually most crystallographers would be careful to do a gradient thing to find out what the form of the protein was in relatively non-concentrated solution.
Right. So this is where the crystal would grow.
This is not where the crystal would grow. They have the crystal, and then they would normally try to do an experiment in a solution that would be equivalent to a biological, or try to be equivalent to the biological concentration.
So you're saying that this may be actually relevant.
So the evidence, I think, is that this is often very relevant, actually. The dominant, there are exceptions, but usually.
Tom? Yeah, Janet, there were two correlators I expected you to mention at some point. Maybe you did, but I missed them. One is, I have the thought that if you're making multimers, then clearly each element there has more than one binding area.
Yes, yeah. Okay.
So I would have thought some geometrical correlator of the angle or relative displacement of those two binding sites would be one. Second thing, very briefly, is because of your comment on delta G all the time, thought that one element of delta G the interface doesn't really control is the dynamic change on binding. I thought that loose or floppy low-frequency modes and how those are changed by binding would contribute largely to delta G, and I wondered if you knew anything about that.
So, in terms of the first question, there is no doubt, obviously, that, for example, to form a trimer, you effectively have to form a molecule which kind of has 120-degree thing.
Right.
And you get, and in fact, I've not got, but Thomas Kabir has looked at the separate, the relatively size of the two interfaces, and the symmetry and not symmetry that one has to consider in that. So I think, yes, that is an important thing which we haven't really tried to use predictively, but I agree it would be very sensible to do that. The second is that... what was the second
question?
When
you bind, you might stiffen up internal
dynamics. You might stiffen up, okay. That's quite difficult with the... obviously, with the obligates, you can't see. but very often... there are examples where that is very true, and there are clear examples where that probably is not true. And many of the the heterocomplexes actually derive their affinity by being perfect matches and not being floppy. So it depends what affinity you're at, etc.
Okay. Well, one last question.
I was actually just going to ask, if you look at hetero, or even if you look at a globular protein, chop it in two, is the problem then much easier? Or do you still have the same? I remember David Eisenberg was talking about in some cases you have two subunits, in other cases you have separate proteins.
So is the prediction problem easier?
Right. So if you take heterodimers, or if you took a globular protein that had two subunits,
does
the problem then become much more tractable?
So my view is that the homomerics are more predictive because the hydrophobic component is usually larger, and therefore you can recognise them, actually. But this is, I have to say, it's harder. It must be harder in the non-obligates. It must be harder. But to some extent, you should talk to Hannes about that.
Okay, perhaps we should end the discussion there.
Shall I just leave?